All right, today is the 10th, right? 10th?
Do you know when our last day of class is?
No, I don't know. It's so kind of vague these days,
yes.
Because we just always have one service. It used to be, of course, you'd have two services, then you go to one service, and that was very clear, but not as much now.
Are we meeting next week?
Easter? No, next week is Easter. I guess we're not. Well, that's fortunate because we'll be sort of at a stopping place. We're talking about William James. I don't know if you know anything about what we've been doing, but we've been talking about William James, who's probably the best known American philosopher, and he's a pragmatist, and he had a lot to say about philosophy of religion, and that's why he's of interest in a Sunday school class. And several of the works that he wrote are about what pragmatism is, and we start off with that, but that was some time ago. But then another several works that he wrote are indeed about religion, about philosophy of religion, what religion is, the various kinds of religion, all that sort of thing. His most famous work is called The Will to Believe, where he defends the idea that a purely scientific perspective is too narrow, and that there are other kinds of evidences that are appropriate, and especially where religion is concerned, you're not going to get any kind of scientific certitude. But he thinks that the heart, as it were, has a say in what one should come to believe, and that's the guts of the will to believe, that there's this additional evidence, as it were, that is purely emotional, and that you have to take that into account as well as what you see, what you think, and that sort of thing. A lot of these works, this is useful for everybody actually, just to recapitulate, a lot of these works were really lectures he gave, because he was he's kind of a people person, so I have read. He's had a nice personality and was popular on the lecture circuit. So probably half of the works that are in here were actually originally lectures. And so we're talking about, this will be our last class actually, on the varieties of religious experience. But William James had a chair of philosophy and psychology. And so the variety of religious experiences is partly a psychological study of what religion is like, you know. And just to kind of recap the major themes there, I mean, I would say that there are kind of three major, really, if you look at the big, really big picture, there are three major themes. The first three chapters are concerned with just what religion is. It has to do with the divine in a very, very broad sense of the word. Very broad sense. We talked about that too. You know, exactly what would, because he says, well, it's not necessarily divine per se, but something that's counted as divine. In other words, you have this devotion to something that is just utterly awe-inspiring, whatever that may be. And so it may be God, maybe something else. And then we, of course, talked about, well, does that mean that, you know, devoted communists back, you know, before 1989, maybe, or that was a religion? Well, maybe so. I mean, maybe they were, maybe the social, political ideal is, crosses the threshold where somebody has this kind of emotional reverence for it, as it were. So that was what religion is. And then the second really big theme in the varieties of religious experience has to do with various kinds of religion. And he makes two-fold distinctions. One between what he calls, what I'm calling optimistic versus pessimistic religion, you know. And he definitely falls on the side of the optimistic group. The distinction mostly revolves around the extent to which the religion allows human free will. And, an optimistic religion is one that says, yeah, there is evil in the world, but it's not due to God. God has the last say, and God is good. James, I guess, would be on the side of many people, Ed Moore being one. Some of you may remember Ed Moore from way on back, maybe three of us. he himself was of that stripe, where he said, well, look, if you look at the very beginning of the book of Genesis and you read it carefully, it's not that God creates things out of nothing. God, there's something there already, right? There's the waters of chaos or something like that that's there, where God begins to create the universe. So in other words, there's something outside of God that can influence things, and evil then could be accounted for by whatever is outside of God. In that case, the problem of evil, which is, of course, the problem, how can an omnipotent and benevolent being allow there to be evil in the world, is addressed by simply saying, well, God is not omnipotent. You know, Ed Moore would say that, really, that there are forces out there that are beyond God's control, there are nuances you can develop here, but I mean, maybe God's voluntary control. God could take control of them if God wanted to, but, God chooses not to.
That's also the essential theme behind when bad things happen to good people.
I still didn't hear what you said.
That's also the essential gist of when bad things happen.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, that is the same sort of theme. Yeah. Now, of course, if you make that...
Freeze, but I want to hear.
Yeah, which is more important?
I want to listen.
Of course, if you make that move, then you're kind of back in the sticky wicket again. Then why does God allow there to be freewheeling evil out there? So maybe you're better off just saying God is limited. Well, another one is Tom Ord. Remember Tom Ord?
Yeah.
He was in here. He gave a talk in church a couple of years ago, maybe, and he was in here that Sunday. And I got to know him a little bit, and I signed up for his newsletter, so I get newsletters every so often. He's out in Idaho. That's where he is. It's a Nazarene church, I think, is where he... but anyway, he also would say the same thing, that God's power is limited, which, of course, is the better alternative than saying that God is omnipotent and evil and conniving at the whole thing. Well, anyway, so that's the optimistic religion. But that God... And this is William James's analogy, which is a really good one. You know, God is like a grandmaster. Remember that? The chess grandmaster. Mm-hmm. God's not controlling everything any more than a chess grandmaster is controlling everything in the game. The grandmaster doesn't know what move I'm going to make. But the grandmaster does know whatever move I make, it can be countered very easily because this person is a grandmaster, you know. Well, God is the cosmic grandmaster, and whatever move is made, whatever move is made by the forces of evil, God can ultimately counter the whole business. And so the optimistic religion holds that it'll all come out in the end. God's in his heaven. Not all's right with the world, but all will be right with the world, right? And I keep on quoting that hymn, right? This is my father. The last verse of "This is my father's world," right? This is my. If I can't remember it, this is my father's world. Let me ne'er forget that though the wrong be oft so strong, God is the ruler yet. This is my father's world. Why should my heart be sad? The Lord is king. Let the heavens ring. God reigns. Let the earth be glad. So that's exactly what that is.
So
exactly. The grandmaster. Okay? That's the optimistic religion. The pessimistic religion is represented, in my mind, by Al-Ghazali. We talked about Al-Ghazali last year when we were doing Islamic stuff. And he's such a wonderful representative of the God is absolutely in control and of everything, and is the absolute sovereign of everything, and everything that happens is due to God, evil as well as good. And if you've got a problem with that, tough. You know, that's kind of the way it works out. And so William James, of course, we classify that as a pessimistic religion because, well, if God is responsible for everything and everything includes evil, then where does that leave us? But, of course, we're not supposed to say God is evil in any way because God commands us not to say that, even though, well, you know. So anyway, that's the pessimistic version of religion. The other distinction he makes with religions is between what I'm, once again, these are my terms, but a religion of the heart versus a religion of the head. And I guess it's pretty obvious, given his pragmatistic allegiance, that it's that the heart. Hi. Oh, yeah, by all means. Hey.
Sorry, we're late.
Oh, my goodness, you brought a special guest. Wow. Well, welcome. Well, you came just in time, because I'm just standing here summarizing the varieties of religious experience. And I was talking about, what religion is, and I was talking about the contrast between optimistic and pessimistic religions, and which is one of the big contrasts, and he's on the side of the optimists. And then, of course, then the other big theme is, is religion mainly a matter of the heart or of the head? You know, that's the second question that he asks. And, you know, being a pragmatist and being the one who's saying, and is it still up on the board? Yeah. Being the one who's saying, okay, you know, your typical positivist, your scientist type person is going to say, oh, there are just two criteria for something's being meaningful, even. Is it something I can observe? That's perception. Or is it something that I can deductively infer given, like mathematical reasoning, deductive inference? Either of these two is legit. If a proposition is neither empirically confirmable nor is it a deductive consequence of something else that's true, then, in the extreme case, it's just meaningless, right? Now, William James, the pragmatist, says, no, that's too narrow. We need to add, I glossed it as gut feeling. We need to add one's emotional being. I mean, we are human beings. Your observations, your perceptions, and your thoughts do not exhaust the sum total of human experience. And so it's not just that perception gets a vote and plus thinking gets a vote, but willing, i.e. gut feeling, gets a vote too. And when all is said and done, not just two, but all three need to get factored together to decide what you're going to believe, right? That's the idea. I mean, James, it is very interesting. When we started talking about all this, you know, I started off talking about the positivists. That's all these circles, of where they came from, you know? The circles represent the boundaries of knowledge. And James's pragmatism is coming out of the positivistic tradition. The difference is that James wants to take those circles, or that circle, rather, and do like that, and make it a much bigger circle, whereas the logical positivists of the 1930s wanted to go the opposite direction. You know, this is humankind here. They wanted to go and shrink it down and really, you know, tighten up what is acceptable versus what's not. But James, the pragmatist, simply wants to take that and go like that, make it a much bigger circle, so it includes our emotional nature as well as what we see and what we think, right? And so, and if you do that, then that will put religion within inside the circle. It won't be outside the circle anymore, because indeed, religion for James is more a matter of the heart than of the head. Yeah. So that is really, really important, you know, and it's a reasonable defense. You know, I've learned a lot in all this, and so that's the second big theme. The first big theme is what is religion. Second big theme is these contrasts between optimistic and pessimistic, and the heart and the head religions. Then the third big theme is not even a theme. It's like, okay, here's everything else. You know, here's the miscellany. And, you know, so he talks about conversion. And we spent a week talking about James's account of conversion. Once again, it has a lot to do, it has a lot to do with the subconscious. Remember, there's various kinds of conversion. It can be either somebody who has alternatives already in one's head that one is aware of, and one simply decides to go with this one rather than this one. Or it could be something on the other, absolute other extreme, something that is not even part of one's own consciousness, but somehow is like getting hit on the head or something, just this traumatic event in your life totally reorganizes how you think. And, you know, then there it is, a new framework for thinking and so forth. So that was, you know, conversion. And then he was talking about saintliness and characteristics of somebody that we regard as saintly. A saintly person often is a founder of a religion or a founder of a subdivision of, like Luther say, I wouldn't call him saintly though. Anyway, but yeah, a founder of Saint Francis. How's that? He doesn't found Christianity or anything, but does found the Franciscan order. And so then the final miscellaneous theme, which we started last week, is, okay, well, even though religion is a matter of the heart and not of the head, and James even goes so far as to say that the head doesn't have very much of a role to play unless you're talking about religion. If you're exploring a science of religion, as I am, he says, in the varieties of religious experience, that's what we're not doing religion, we're talking about religion, a sort of a second order investigation. So maybe he shouldn't have added those last two chapters or those lectures, because in those he goes back down to the first level again and is really telling us what his own religious commitments are and what he actually believes as a believer. And I thought we'd be able to finish it up last week, and we had so much discussion that we didn't. And so this week we will finish it up, I trust. We basically got over, it's two chapters worth, so we basically got over the first of the two chapters last week. I have to tell you, I spent so much time doing my taxes. I haven't even had a chance to review this. It was so painful, so painful. Our taxes are so complicated, and I may just pay somebody to do them next year. I don't know, but I got turbo tax, and so I'm doing my taxes, and then they ask me some question. I don't even know what the question means. You know, which percentage of these are U.S. obligations? What does that even mean?
I don't know what it means.
I don't know. So of course, I wound up on the phone with this person from this investment company that we have, and this one, and so forth, and so on. Oh my gosh.
You can solve that by just giving away all your money, Don.
Well, you know, I have to tell you.
Then you have nothing to worry about.
No, they told me what I should do, and it wasn't easy, especially in one case. In one case, it was right there it was like on page 15 or something, but and the other one, I had to do a bunch of calculations and all this. Oh, what a mess. So by the end, you know what I originally was planning to do? Once I finish this, I'm going to go back and I'm going to check all the numbers, make sure I'm absolutely right. I was so sick of it. I just said,
submit.
I don't care.
Oh.
You know?
Will you send them off already?
They're gone. They're gone.
Don, what was that Ross family motto? Success breeds hope. What do you think?
Exactly.
Huh?
I don't know what that means. Yeah.
Isn't that right? Success
breeds
hope.
That's right. That's what it was. Yes, exactly.
Do you use TurboTax?
I do. I use TurboTax. Oh. Well, anyway, I have diverged a little bit from William James, but I was explaining why I haven't had a chance to go over this. Yeah. Well, anyway, so at the end of the second to the last chapter, Other Characteristics is the name of it, he sort of begins this theme which I've called Neoplatonism. And when all is said and done, William James, as a religious thinker, is a Neoplatonist. Now you say, well, what's a Neoplatonist? Well, I have on the board, I've got a picture, which is not very, doesn't well, exactly leap right out at you because the markers are not so great. But Plotinus, the founder of Neoplatonism, has this idea that, well, he calls it the One. Yeah, that's God, basically. That's his term. And everything just kind of flows from the One, emanates out from the One. The One, as it were, overflows with being. I use it often as an analogy. I used to be fascinated with this as a kid. I don't even know where it is. But there at least were, probably still are, fountains downtown where you have a big bowl on the bottom and a medium-sized bowl in the middle and a little bowl at the top, right? Mm-hmm. And then the water is spewing out up here. And it's filling up the little bowl and it overflows.
Right.
And that overflows into the big bowl. I used to think that was so cool. Well, that's, I guess whoever constructed the fountain was a Neoplatonist because it's sort of a metaphor mm-hmm. for emanation. You know, the One, as it were, overflows with being, brings into being, the Greek word is nous, which is mind or spirit. It's hard to translate. And then in turn overflows to the level of soul, and then emanation doesn't go any farther than that. At the very limit of it, you have the physical world, but the physical world, Plotinus is really an idealist. In other words, there is no physical world. It's just an outer appearance of a spiritual world. But what's of interest here is this realm of soul is our normal everyday life. Our normal everyday life, this is where our consciousness resides. It's just at the level of soul. The level of nous, let alone the level of the One, is something that we don't even, are not usually aware of, usually. That's not to say we can't be, I mean, if one ever did become aware of the One, that is mystical experience. That's like realizing one's unity with God, you know. And according to Porphyry, Plotinus' biographer, Plotinus had a mystical experience four times in his life, okay. That's it. But anyway, most of the time, like 99.999 blah, 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 percent of the time, your consciousness is right here. So if you wanted to take a Plotinus and translate him into more modern terminology, you would have to say, well, this is the realm of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Even though the diagram, you'd almost have to make it maybe upside down or something, but this is the realm of subconsciousness. You know, something you're not really conscious, but it's there. It's there. And occasionally, it floats into consciousness or something like that. So James, at the very end of the other characteristics chapter, makes, remember, a distinction between the A region and the B region of consciousness, of the brain even. I don't know how else to put it. The A region is soul. You know, this is where what we're usually conscious of. The B region is this region that is there, it's in our heads, but our consciousness is just not, it's usually not a factor in our conscious life. You know, you might even say, I mean, there's been a lot of research done in the last 50 years on a lot of that. And, you know, there's this whole phenomenon of blindsight, right? Where they have presented images that go to the right brain. You know, your left brain is your conscious self, and it's your verbal abilities and all that stuff is in your left brain. Right brain doesn't have any of that, but they would do these experiments where the image would go through the left eye to the right brain. Person's not even aware of what he or she is seeing. But they would ask the person, what are you thinking of? And the person would, you know, like 75% of the time, would say what it was that the right brain was seeing without even knowing it. Well, that's like the B region, right? There's all, and of course, James mentions, and we've all had the experience of, you can't think of a name, right? Or something like that. And try to think of it.
Oh, yeah.
Finally, you just give up. And 2 hours later, boing, there it is.
Oh, yeah, Patty.
Yeah, exactly.
Her name is Patty.
Or, yeah, exactly. Or Don. That's even worse. But anyway, you know, obviously something's going on, right?
There's something's
churning back there. You're just not aware of it. And so that's the B region. And it religion is like that.
Yes.
I mean, that is, the religion then is, the region of religion is the B region. So let me read you now from the conclusions, which is almost just a continuation of that same theme. So I'm going to read you a bunch of passages here from conclusions. The world of our experience consists at all times of two parts, an objective and a subjective part, of which the former may be incalculably more extensive than the latter. Okay, and yet the latter can never be omitted or suppressed. The objective part is the sum total of whatsoever at any given time we may be thinking of. The subjective part is the inner state in which the thinking comes to pass. What we think of may be enormous, cosmic times and spaces, for example, whereas the inner state may be the most fugitive and paltry activity of mind. Yet, the cosmic objects, so far as the experience yields them, are but ideal pictures of something whose existence we do not inwardly possess, but only point at outwardly, while the inner state is our very experience itself. Its reality and that of our experience are one. A conscious field plus its object as felt or thought of, plus an attitude towards the object, plus the sense of the self to whom the attitude belongs. Such a concrete bit of personal experience may be small, but it is a solid bit as long as it lasts. Not hollow, not a mere abstract element of experience, just as the object is when taken all alone. It is a full fact, even though it be an insignificant fact. It is the kind to which all realities whatsoever must belong. The motor currents of the world run through the like of it. It is on the line connecting real events with real events. That unshareable feeling which each one of us has of the pinch of this individual destiny as he privately feels it rolling out on fortune's wheel may be disparaged for its egotism, may be sneered at as unscientific, but is the one thing that fills up the measure of our concrete actuality, and any would-be existent that should lack such a feeling or its analog would be a piece of reality only half made up. Okay, so in other words, there's this objective world out there, and we explore it scientifically and so forth and so on, but let's not forget that there's the inner world of subjective experience, which is not just the experience of the sensations of the world, but the attitudes, he says, and the self that's connected with the attitudes, all that sort of stuff. That's what constitutes the richness of our inner experience, and of course that will be the locus of religious experience, unlike in the Middle Ages, where for people like Thomas Aquinas, God is almost like a scientific hypothesis to explain how motion can be sustained, to explain a causal chain, and the chain comes to an end at a first cause, all that sort of thing. No. Religion and God and so forth are not a scientific hypothesis for James. To the contrary, it's a matter of one's inner experience, just as it was for Plotinus.
On that point, Don, so he seems to be the guy, kind of guy who has, even in the intervening 100-plus years, more and more of what's going on in the world can be explained by science.
Right.
Religion is down to almost nothing left, unless you want to get into the Big Bang.
Oh, yeah, well, as a scientific theory. Yes, right.
That's outside science.
Yes.
So he clearly was on the trend in his life. Mm-hmm. 1800s, tremendous progress.
Well, early 1900s. But
yeah,
yes.
So I would think that he would have no problem with religion getting down to basically retreating on the scientific front over the centuries and continuing up to today.
That's what he says.
There's not much more to go, probably.
Yeah. Well, that's what he's saying. I mean, if you want to call it retreating, okay, fine.
I mean, to some people, it's retreating.
Yeah, but in other words, it's the opposite from, say, Thomas Aquinas, who thinks of God as basically a scientific theory. I mean, partly as a scientific theory. And no, it has nothing to do with science, but has everything to do with one's inner life. But that's what makes him a Neoplatonist, because that's exactly what Plotinus was saying. You know? If this be true, it is absurd for science to say that the egotistic elements of experience should be suppressed. The axis of reality runs solely through the egotistic places. They are strung upon it like so many beads. To describe the world with all the various feelings of the individual pinch of destiny, all the various spiritual attitudes left out from the description, they being as describable as anything else, would be something like offering a printed bill of fare as the equivalent for a solid meal. Remember the example or the figure he used before about, you know, well, a real raisin is a lot better, tastes a lot better than R-A-I-S-I-N, you know, than the word spelled out. That is how you spell it, right? Religion makes no such blunder. What?
Sorry, I'm talking to my
Religion makes no such blunder. The individual's religion may be egotistic, and these private realities which it keeps in touch with may be narrow enough, but at any rate, it always remains infinitely less hollow and abstract, as far as it goes, than a science, which prides itself on taking no account of anything private at all. Right? So the positivists over here, they're the ones who want to take that circle and go like that and say everything is outside it is simply meaningless, which would be all private experience, of course. And James is saying, no, you've got to take the circle and go like that. A bill of fare. Oh, no, this was it. Oh, I guess I didn't read it. I did remember reading it before. It was in my right brain, but now it comes at the A bill of fare with one real raisin, I just spelled it right, on it instead of the word raisin, or with one real egg instead of the word egg, might be an inadequate meal, but it would be at least be a commencement of reality. So, yeah. So the scientific view is like R-A-I-S-I-N. Not very filling. Well, not very, very pleasant. There's nothing to eat there, but a real raisin is what religion is like. Okay, again. The individual, so far as he suffers from his wrongness and criticizes it, is to that extent consciously beyond it, and in at least possible touch with something higher, if anything higher exists. Along with the wrong part, there is thus a better part of him, even though it may be but a most helpless germ. So this is getting back to the A region and the B region again, right? Our own experience, normal experience, is the A region. There's a B region there. Something's going along, you know, which we're not usually aware of. The man identifies his real being, though, with the germinal higher part of himself. You know, what am I? What am I? Okay, let's ask that question to Plotinus. What am I? Okay. Well, Plotinus says, what am I as an individual is here. Not here, but my true self is nous, and that's the B region, to translate it into Jamesian terminology. My true self is here. Actually, my truest self is the one, right? But insofar as I'm a discrete being, different from you and you and you and you and so forth and so on, my true being here is at the level of nous. Well, in James's terminology, my true being is in the B region. It's this region that's, you know, that's not even part of my normal conscious life, but the higher part of himself. And does so in the following way. He becomes conscious that this higher part is continuous and continuous with a more of the same quality, which is operative in the universe outside of him, and which he can keep in working touch with. Well, isn't that Plotinian? Isn't that like Plotinus? As I just said, you know, my being as a discrete, my essence as a discrete being is here, but it's in touch with, as he put it, something that's operative in the universe outside God, aka the One, right? So it's the same idea that my truest self is something in this B region, something in the subconscious, but something in the higher regions of my being, and that in turn is somehow in touch with the being with a capital B, the being of the universe, as it were. If that's not Neoplatonism, I don't know what is, right? It seems to me that all the phenomena are accurately describable in these very simple general terms. They allow for the divided self and the struggle. They involve the change of personal center and the surrender of the lower self. They express the appearance of exteriority of the helping power and yet account for our sense of union with it. Okay, that's just sort of a summary of what I just read. Ha! Okie dokie. Let's go on. More stuff along the same lines. Here he's quoting from, well, my thing has covered it up, but some Myers, I think, is the name of the guy, a researcher, who says this: each of us is in reality an abiding psychical entity far more extensive than he knows. Right? It's a B region as well as an A region. An individuality which can never express itself completely through any corporeal manifestation. The self manifests through the organism, but there is always some part of the self unmanifested, and always, as it seems, some power of organic expression in abeyance or reserve. That's the end of the quote. James goes on, much of the content of this larger background against which our conscious being stands out in relief is insignificant. Imperfect memories, silly jingles, inhibitive timidities, dissolutive phenomena of various sorts, as Myers calls them, enter into it for a large part. But in it, many of the performances of genius seem to have their origin. And in our study of conversion, of mystical experience, and of prayer, we have seen how striking a part invasions from this region play in the religious life. There are invasions from the B region, as it were, into the A region, and they play a decisive role in the religious life. Let me then propose as a hypothesis that whatever it may be on its farther side, the more with which in religious experience we feel ourselves connected is on its hither side the subconscious continuation of our conscious life. Starting thus with a recognized psychological fact as our basis, we seem to preserve a contact with science which the ordinary theologian lacks. At the same time, the theologian's contention that the religious man is moved by an external power is vindicated, for it is one of the peculiarities of invasions from the subconscious region to take objective appearances and to suggest to the subject an external control. In the religious life, the control is felt as higher. But since on our hypothesis, it is primarily the higher faculties of our own hidden mind which are controlling, the sense of union with the power beyond us is a sense of something not merely apparently but literally true. So, I'm sure you're getting the picture by now. There's, you know, justus pluripotentius, there's this region that's my true self, but he thinks of it as higher, I guess. Well, James uses the word higher too, but when you think of it, I guess, as subconscious, I think we often think of it as deeper. I mean, I think we sort of typically reverse the images, right? I used the metaphor last time of the ocean and how the upper, 20 feet or whatever it is of the ocean is full of light. You know, light will penetrate the water, but then it, maybe it's more than that, but I don't know, whatever. But at some point, you sort of cross a threshold, and it's nothing but darkness farther down. Well, I think that's a wonderful metaphor for exactly what we're thinking about, because the conscious region, then, is the part that's full of light. We're aware of it. We see what's going on and all that sort of stuff. But that's just the surface. And there's this incredible depth that goes down hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of feet. You know, the dark, we don't know what's there, but occasionally, something will well up from the depths into the light. That's the idea. I'll be darned. The further limits of our being plunge, it seems to me, into an altogether other dimension of existence from the sensible and merely understandable world. Name it the mystical region or the supernatural region, whichever you choose. So far as our ideal impulses originate in this region, and most of them do originate in it, for we find them possessing us in a way for which we cannot accurately account, we belong to it in a more intimate sense than that in which we belong to the visible world. For we belong to the most intimate, we belong in the most intimate sense wherever our ideals belong. Yet the unseen region in question is not merely ideal, for it produces effects in this world. When we commune with it, work is actually done upon our finite personality. For we are turned into new men, and consequences in the way of conduct follow in the natural world upon our regenerative change. But that which produces effects with another reality must be termed a reality itself. So I feel as if we had no philosophic excuse for calling the unseen or mystical world unreal. If the dark regions occasionally bubble up into the light, we certainly can't call the dark regions unreal. They're really there. Okay. God is the natural appellation, for us Christians at least, for the supreme reality. So I will call this higher part of the universe by the name of God. God's existence. Oh yes, and so this is the last quote. This all gets connected with James's his allegiance to an optimistic version of reality of religion. I mean, an optimistic version of religion. God is the Grandmaster theme, right? God's existence is the guarantee of an ideal order that we shall be permanently preserved. This world may indeed, as science assures us, someday burn up or freeze, but if it is part of his order, the old ideals are sure to be brought elsewhere to fruition, so that where God is, tragedy is only provisional and partial. And shipwreck and dissolution are not the absolutely final things. Only when this farther step of faith concerning God is taken and some remote objective consequences are predicted does religion, as it seems to me, get wholly free from the first immediate subjective experience and bring a real hypothesis into play. So, James, as a religious person, I mean, he's partly a person who's writing about religion, but of course, that's the second, what we call the second order William James, as it were. But then there's the first order William James as a religious person. What is religion? What is my religion? What is my religion? Well, it, in essence, it's the A region versus the B region, otherwise known as soul and nous. And then there's God, otherwise known as the One, which the B region is somehow in contact with. And usually we're not even aware of it, but occasionally it will bubble up from the depths and come into the light, and we become aware of stuff that's in the region that's normally subconscious. And then, because that in turn, once again, something that bubbles up is its connection with a universal entity that we would call God. Because of that, then we can formulate the hypothesis, say, that the Lord is king, let the heavens ring, God reigns, let the earth be glad. You know, the idea that, yes, there is evil, but there's a grandmaster there who knows all the moves to make. So that the evil that exists is only provisional. So therefore, looking back on the twofold distinctions of religion, right? The first one, of course, being the optimistic versus the pessimistic religion. The second one being the religion of the heart versus the religion of the head. We can easily identify where James belongs, right? As a matter of fact, I love matrices. Everybody knows I love matrices. I don't even have room to. I'll draw it inside here. Okay.
But mixed metaphors.
Right, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if this is optimistic and this is pessimistic, and this is the religion of the heart versus the religion of the. Oops.
draw a heart.
HD, how's that? Heart and head. Well, where does religion belong? Where does James belong?
Oh, upper left.
Exactly.
That's right.
Right there.
Yes.
Religion and your pal, Al Ghazali.
He's pessimistic and probably
both
hard, a lot hard. Okay, yeah. Okay, all. How about that? Aquinas, of course. You know, it's a much more of a scientific idea and so forth. But anyway, yeah. William James clearly is an advocate of a religion of the heart. And but of the optimistic variety, because of the Grand Master that we all accept, if we are modern Neoplatonists. And I think you have to admit, he comes across as a early 19th and 20th century Neoplatonist. Now, we take Plotinus' terminology and we update it, we link it in with scientific, you know, psychological theories and subconscious, the whole language thing. But once you translate it back, you realize it's Plotinus got it right, at least by James's lights. We just maybe need to update his terminology. So therefore, James is a modern Neoplatonist. So, yes?
Can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
So his vision there was that the conscious was a way to let positive things flow from the subconscious toward God and all that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Versus the opposite, which is that your conscience is to suppress the subconscious.
Like, yeah.
You know, like, let's just say even in religion, all the moral instruction, you know, it's a bad idea for me to have a girlfriend in every city around the country, even if my subconscious wants one. I can't do that.
Yeah.
Right? So your conscious has a gatekeeper to keep it, as opposed to an opening, it's a closing.
Well, or maybe not either one or the other, but a gatekeeper who lets in the immigrants that have that are Ukrainian or whatever, but keeps out the ones that are from Central America, that kind of thing. If you want to use that analogy, but I mean it's a limited sort of thing. It's the gatekeeper. Some of it is okay, some of it's not okay. So it's not quite a all or nothing sort of thing. Well, anyway, so we have a pluralistic universe left. And I guess we won't meet next week then, but the week after next, and it will not be nearly as long. We won't be I always wind up predicting far less time than we always take. But I would have thought 1 week, maybe 2 weeks, but maybe more. I don't know. But that will be sort of the same, along the same lines, because by pluralistic he means anti-Hegelian. He thinks of Hegel as his sort of philosophic enemy. And so, so see you in 2 weeks, and we'll talk about that.
Still like Kierkegaard, Hegel is philosophic enemy.
In some ways, yes. Yeah, that's right. Kierkegaard couldn't stand Hegel either. Yeah.
You still hope to fit some Wittgenstein?
Yes, I do. Yeah, we'll see. But then the question is, when do we go to? I don't know the answer to that one. You know, when does summer break start? I guess I'll find out. But we'll see.
Anyway. Usual dividing line.
Memorial Day weekend. It's not what was it?
Memorial Day weekend.
Oh, okay. Well, that's the end of May, right?
It's the beginning of the.
Okay, maybe that's what we'll do.
Does the calendar have any? Can the calendar give any clues?
Maybe, I don't know. I can look.
Right.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye, Bonnie. Bye, Marty.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Gail. Nice. Yes.
Thanks, Don.
Uh-huh.
All right. Let's go to our activities.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to tell Marty that they hate this
one. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, hey, we got up to 69. Sally?
I'm actually hot. Of course, I got a sweater on. I've been standing up here talking.
To it.
So, Jay, next time we're here, it's chilly week.
We'll be traveling for a few weeks, so I'll miss the next several.
Okay.
But All right.
I'll be back.
Okay, good. Well, so nice to have you, too.
Yeah, Don, you know, I rarely get an opportunity. I feel like so.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I hope you can, you know, get more opportunities. So.
You know, I was thinking while you were talking, you know, I was reminding from a Chinese history class. There's a Chinese philosopher, Mencius, who...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm glad you came to society corrupt.
That's right. Where you thought James would be on that. Would he be of a sort of like our inner, our part B self, kind of the source of our virtue, you know, or the other way around?
Yeah.
I feel like the other question.
Yeah, it's sort of, kind of drawing on that.
It's sort of parallel, isn't it? I mean, although it's not, of course, James's optimism is not based on an individual human's goodness, but on the universe as a whole goodness, right? So I would say it's analogous. I wouldn't say it's the same thing as Mencius.
Right.
But
certainly that sort of sense of, like, people are intrinsically good.
Yeah.
You can harness that as opposed to people are inherently immoral and you got to civilize.
Yeah, right. That's, the general optimism that you find in Mencius is similar in that respect. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah,
okay.
Really good point.
Okay.
So anyway.
Thank you, Don.
Alrighty.
Yep.
See ya.
Yeah.